ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot, sponsored by Crew Chief Systems. My name is Hal Bryan, and I'm EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications, and I'm one of your hosts today. Over there at the other end of the big long table, it is
Tom Charpentier, Government Relations Director.
And Tom, we are joined today over the internet by Zach Reeder, who is a test pilot and engineering chief at Joby Aviation. Zach, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's terrific to have you. So as we dive in, why don't you give us just a little bit of a primer on Joby Aviation itself, and then we'll talk about your role there and all the good stuff you guys are doing.
Okay. Joby's a startup aviation company. They started in 2009 and are trying to build an electric eVTOL air taxi that's super safe and quiet.
And can you describe just kind of the current design of the vehicle right now? For those who haven't seen it, is it kind of a helicopter looking thing? Is it kind of an airplane looking thing? Is it kind of both? What is it? How does it work?
So the Joby aircraft, they're real careful about saying aircraft and not airplane, is got six propellers. It's a high wing with a V-tail, pilot seat up front in the middle, and four passenger seats, kind of like a Dragon Rapide. The propellers tilt up for takeoff and landing. So it takes off and lands vertically like a helicopter. And then the propellers tilt down, sort of like a V-22 or something. And we cruise like an airplane and go hopefully super fast and super quiet. It's on a tricycle landing gear. It's got differential hydraulic brakes and a castoring nose wheel.
So Zach, with that that tilt mechanism, I know, for example, with the V-22, it's not possible. Is it possible for Joby to land in the sort of the fixed wing configuration?
Yeah, and we for certification we got to show the ability to do like a energy exhaustion gliding landing. Okay. And then for us, the sweet spot is rolling landings with the tilts partially down. Like if we're doing a maximum range flight, that's how we get the maximum range. But the mission is the vertical takeoff and landing. So
sure.
Like all the vertiports and cities that we want to go to are there. And so we've been heavily focused on that vertical mission.
So I guess before we get a little too much farther into the development of the aircraft and your role in it, could you give us a little bit of a background of how you made your way into test flying the aircraft? What's your background in aviation? How did you get started?
Oh man, I grew up in East Texas. My dad's an engineer and pilot, flight instructor. We started building an Acro Sport 2 when I was a kid.
Oh wow!
And
very cool.
You know, dad had a grass runway Super Cub in the backyard. Learned to fly in the backyard, lots of model airplanes, sort of the archetypical thing. My first like home building experience was in college. I didn't have my pilot's license yet. And my first solo was in a Regalo hang glider that I designed and built myself, which was
mackerel.
Exciting. I went to Texas A&M, did a lot of student RC projects and like drone projects and stuff like that. And then graduated in 2005, just after the XPRIZE, and went to work for BERT at Scaled out in Mojave, and then spent 14 years at Scaled doing a mix of engineering and flight test stuff, sort of culminating in the Stratolaunch airplane. So I was with you guys in 2018 or 2019 after the Stratolaunch first flight.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then, and then I came to Joby in 2019. I never like applied for a job. I had friends that talked about Joby. They had come here and it was like a legend. They were in a gravel quarry in the Redwood Forest, secretly testing this new vehicle underground, and they could get me a tour, but they needed a resume to justify the tour. And at some point during the tour, after we saw impressive stuff, people started asking me really hard questions, and I realized I was being ambushed into a job interview.
That's awesome.
But what I saw, and specifically, I heard the airplane during like high power tie down test on the ground, and was like blown away by a lot of what I saw. So I actually like asked to come back for a second interview just to ask questions about what they were thinking, and ended up coming here.
Got it.
And then I was moving from at Scaled. I was a test pilot at the end of my time there, and moved over to kind of an engineering test pilot role here, which has been awesome.
Well, I'm sorry we didn't put two and two together there when we had you on there. I think this might be the first time on the Green Dot, Hal, that we've had one of our guests actually kind of in an evolving career as we've had them back talking to them. That's really cool. So you mentioned that it's kind of a tilt rotor type aircraft. Obviously, it's not there's not a direct analog out there in the aviation world for really anything that you guys are doing. But what did you do to kind of prepare for this this flight testing role? Did you get any tilt rotor time somewhere else or anything like that?
No, we do tons of simulation. I did. I only had a fixed wing background and had like a little bit of R-22 experience before I came here, and I got the commercial helicopter. And we've got an R-44 that we use as a chase plane. Mm-hmm. And so that rotary wing experience and like the thrust borne experience is super valuable. But we've since then, some of our new pilots are going straight from fixed wing background through the sim into the S-4 and doing inhabited flights without any rotary wing background. So it's definitely not a requirement.
It's fascinating to me. I was really struck by Tom's question. Did you get any tilt rotor experience? And it's like, you know, where would you go and get that? And how would you, but that raises the question for potential future operators of a Joby design. And we'll, maybe we'll get into the autonomy piece of it in just a minute, but what do you foresee is the training path for a pilot?
Yeah. So the, y'all seen the airplane's a powered lift, or the aircraft is a powered lift aircraft at this point.
Right.
So that's a new category, which is super exciting, but there's also not a good way to get powered lift credentials. And so there's lots of discussion around that. The training's going to look a lot like a type rating, but I think the Joby, we've got a training academy set up, they're building curriculum and we're putting pilots through it that is focused on doing a like zero experience development all the way through, you know, commercially operating an S-4 with the expectation that, you know, it's a big fleet size doing lots of commercial operations.
So this essentially be a, like a 135 air taxi operation when it's fully operational.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we've got, we went ahead and set up, got a new 135 certificate and they have a Cirrus on it right now just to like exercise the mechanism.
Okay. That's right. I'd seen your press release. I had heard that. So that's kind of a proof of concept for just kind of developing the infrastructure for those kinds of regular ops while the full product, the full aircraft is still coming up online. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the operation side of the company. I work for the side that's making the plane that owns Flight Desk. So I hate to speculate on what all their plans are, but it's easier to add an airplane to an existing 135 than to try to take a new crazy skycopter thing and you know, start the 135 with simultaneously.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I love that as a marketing tagline, crazy skycopter thing. That's just fantastic. Well, maybe if you would, Zach, can you give us some numbers? And you were talking about sort of maximum range and you know, that concept that's a little bit foreign to us as to fixed wing pilots of making sure you have enough energy left to land safely. Helicopter pilots have to be aware of that. And in this new powered lift category, certainly they do. But what do you see or what are your aspirations for range and endurance and speed and those sorts of things?
Yeah, it's a complicated question because the electric propulsion and the vertical takeoff and landing, plus the ability to safely accommodate any conceivable you know, failure that could happen and making sure that we've got good performance is a super complex space. And so we've been mostly focused on specific markets and specific routes that we want to do and under what conditions we can do them. So it's hard to say like blanket numbers. We are have to do VFR reserve just like any other planning and then an IFR reserve if we were IFR. But the interesting things for these vehicles is, you know, under different conditions, those may not be the limiting cases for planning. So we're having to like calculate contingencies for all the worst options and make sure that we're margined for all of them. But, you know, we're focused on initial routes for the service rollout in Dubai, definitely some stuff on the East Coast. And then there's, you know, LA, eventually San Francisco. There's like all these like city specific routes that we're sort of focused on.
I guess we kind of knew that with the initial rollout, but you're definitely focusing on more urban areas first, which makes sense for kind of the use case that Joby's advertised so far.
Yeah, and it, I mean, the whole point of the commercial service is to save time. But, you know, the sort of envisioned way that these things would work is you pull your phone out, there's an app, you say you want to go from where you're at to a destination, and the air taxis are only going to be able to operate from vertiports that are, you know, in select locations. They'll be, you know, modified tops of parking garages or new bespoke structures. But in most cases, you know, there's going to be some amount of travel to get to one and to get to your final destination. So when you schedule the trip, conceptually, like a rideshare car, like an Uber comes and picks you up, take you to the vertiport, you get on the roof, you get checked in, you get on the aircraft, you do the flight, land, go downstairs, there's another rideshare vehicle waiting for you, and it takes you the last mile of travel.
Sure.
And the distances that you can cover and outrun a car that's stuck in traffic are, you have to go a certain amount of distance to be able to outrun the car traffic. And then once you get to really long distances, the time advantage actually like shrinks a little bit because, you know, you're competing against freeway traffic or whatever, not like stop and go red light traffic in an urban district.
Sure. That does raise the question, though, and I'm sorry to ask so many operational questions, you know, certainly if you don't feel comfortable answering them, that's totally understandable. But how does traffic management look like when you've got, you know, presumably a pretty large volume of these aircraft flying around a major city, mixing in with helicopters and fixed wing and perhaps even some of your competitors out there? How does traffic management work?
Yeah. And again, that's the, like the operation side, not necessarily my department, but I know everybody's worried about ATC volume and how that's going to work. And they've done some simulations with ATC controllers with eVTOL traffic just to see how the flows would work. And I know the operations they're planning with big airports, just the volume load on ATC is a big consideration. I don't know what the current plan is. In the past, you know, we've gotten excited about what Cape Air does, where they get like a, you know, like a corridor clearance, and then the company self-dispatches. I don't know how realistic that is in the near term. So I think the like early rollout service, it's going to look a lot like helicopter traffic. And then as the volume increases, you know, we'll have to do additional things on top of that. Internally, we're doing tons of development on like, you know, how we would do routing and how we would not just like segregate our internal traffic from itself, but also like hide the noise signature in the noise signature of the city. And like, it's definitely a complex space. There's lots of PhDs on that problem.
Sure. Zach, I know that I'd asked the question. You said it was a pretty complicated one, and I respect the idea that you're focusing on specific routes and that sort of end result implementation versus just overall numbers, which I think is a fascinating way to approach it. Very impressive. But you know, for the pilots out there, can you give us like a kind of an average cruise speed and you know, let us know like about how much you can carry and if there is such a thing as a typical scenario?
Yeah. And the publishing numbers has been such a complicated thing. I'm going to like be evasive and not say anything specific. We did one of the early prototypes we've got. We did a 150 mile flight, which is like an hour and 17 minutes.
Okay.
The type design, you know, won't be that performant, especially at max takeoff weight. Like a lot of the routes we're looking at are, you know, like 20 to 40 miles long. And then the exciting thing is the speed. So our best range speed is slower, but our design cruise speed's 145 and our VNE's 160. And just yesterday we were doing a bunch of testing at 160, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah. Anytime we're testing at the red line, that's gotta be exciting, I suppose would be one word for it. So, you know, Zach, we keep punishing you with operational questions and things like that. I'm going to ask you one to switch departments, put your marketing hat on for just a second. And,
Oh man, I just want to talk about flying the airplane.
I know, but this is the flying part. The flying is a big piece of this, but just help our listeners understand, what are the key advantages, like one or two bullets about, doing this kind of operation with a, you know, vertical lift, powered lift category aircraft, versus what we could do today with a helicopter.
Yeah, you bet. Good question. So totally all the sites that we're talking about going to are places that are accessible to helicopters. The big advantage of these types of vehicles are they're quieter than a helicopter, and the noise they do make is like more diffuse without the like really annoying beating noise that helicopters make. So if you've been in lower Manhattan where they've got the like a lot of the air tour helicopter flights, you know, there's like stop the chop signs and like posters and stuff. And so when there's dense helicopter traffic, you know, the communities don't respond well. So that's Joe Ben, the company founder, sort of started with the idea that if you're going to add volume to the urban transportation system, you've got to do it with a noise concept that's going to allow the system to scale. So that's sort of the fundamental thing. It's also the electric vehicles are, you know, zero local emissions, which is great. The thing from an aviation standpoint that I'm excited about is we're bringing complex fly-by-wire to general aviation, which just opens up all kinds of possibilities and also changes, you know, like what the pilot job looks like. So from like an operating standpoint, the all of the like heroic stick and rudder skills that you need when you lose, you know, an engine in a normal aircraft are not required here. And then, you know, the pilot skill kind of moves into like mission management. What do you do in different contingency scenarios than lightning fast reflexes and like, you know, and a well curated silk scarf.
Tom and I were both just sort of tucking our imaginary silk scarves in as you were saying that. So yeah. I think you caught us out.
As was I.
So I understand, you know, these training programs you're developing, you know, you mentioned there's a focus on sort of, you know, zero time through expertise in this, but, based on your experience, as you know, longtime fixed wing and somewhat more recently a rotary wing pilot. If we took a, you know, commercial fixed wing pilot and a commercial helicopter pilot with around the same amount of time, would either of them have any particular advantage in transitioning to something like the Joby? Would the helicopter pilot have a little bit of an edge because they're used to that vertical takeoff and landing regime?
It's hard to say. I think the rotary wing, like familiarity with the low speed thrust borne space, is definitely advantage, like what looks normal. And that, you know, extends to like powered lift pilots. We've got a bunch of F-35B developers and at the company. So I hate to say just rotary wing.
Oh, sure.
But the command strategy that we use is modeled after the F-35, where you've got a left hand control that looks like a throttle that moves fore and aft, that does longitudinal acceleration all the time, whether you're thrust borne or wing borne. And then you've got a right hand inceptor, like a stick on the right side. And if you pull back on the stick, you always go up, whether you're in the chocks or you're doing 160 knots. Wow. Push forward is always down, left is left, right is right. And then the stick twist for the yaw axis, so we don't have traditional rudder pedals. And I think that the idea that rotary wing pilots are used to pulling up on a collective to go up in the hover, or pulling up on the collective as part of forward acceleration, could conceivably be confusing. Whereas fixed wing pilots are used to like forward is forward and pull back on the stick is go up. But it's really the airplane's easy to fly. So I don't know that it's that challenging one way or the other.
So you started talking about the control scheme, which I was curious about. We'll keep asking some more pure flying questions here for you. So is it really that simple? There's no there's no direct nacelle control or anything like that to change the tilt or anything like that. It's all integrated.
Yeah, that's right. It's nobody's ever let me fly an Osprey, although I would love to have the chance. I think they use their tilting propulsion like in incremented tilt settings, like flap settings.
Yeah,
and our tilting system is an active part of the flight control system. So all six of them move independently. They do what they need to do based on what the pilot asks for. And you don't have any direct control over them. And then we have some operational aids that we can use to do regular tasks. Like we have a pilot can set a command speed and then send the command speed at a predetermined acceleration. That's just a constant XL rather than applying steady left-hand control pressure. You can just send the speed, which is how we do most of the takeoffs. So you know, pull back on the stick, come off the ground, one button press to send the speed, and then all of the configuration changes, which is, you know, not just the tilts, but the motor torques and the variable pitch and the RPMs and control surfaces are drooped all the way down to stay out of the downwash and the hover, and they retract up as airspeed comes alive. And AOA management, all of these jobs happen sort of autonomously, but from the pilot's perspective, you've got a flight path marker on the PFD and you keep it above the horizon and enjoy the ride. And then landing's kind of the same way. All the reconversion coming back in is automatic. You point the velocity where you want to go and then tell the airplane whether you want to speed up or slow down. And that's true for all of the failures. So all the failure handling is automatic. There's crew alerts and we've got crew procedures around, you know, different conceptual failures. But in general, you fly the airplane the same way.
Okay, so let's dive a little deeper on the, you mentioned transitioning to the hover, which I think I have never flown a helicopter. I certainly talked to plenty of people who have, and that's one of the trickier skills, flying a helicopter, transitioning to the hover, and certainly other types of powered lift aircraft. When you're entering the hover, can you describe what you're actually doing on the flight controls and then what the aircraft is actually doing with those inputs?
I don't know if I can describe what the aircraft's actually doing with the inputs. Okay. There's a lot happening under the hood. But the airplane changes how it flies when airspeed comes alive. Before that, the climb axis on the right-hand control is controlling height rate. And so what that means is if you let go of the controls, you're commanding no height rate in the hover. So if you're hovering, you stay at whatever altitude you're at. Mm-hmm. When you're, once airspeed's alive and the tilts are coming down, you're controlling flight path angle rate. So you pull back on the stick and the flight path marker goes up, push forward, it comes down.
Right.
So as you come into land, you go through this blended transition between commanding flight path angle and commanding height rate. So as you come into the hover, you're coming downhill, you're slowing down. As airspeed starts getting low, you have to add forward pressure on the control as you get into the height rate. So you're kind of pushing down to continue the descent. And once you get close to your target hover height, you relax the forward pressure and there's no flare. You just let go of the controls and you're hovering. And then we have an augmented hover mode called transitional rate command, which also has legacy in past programs, that it holds you to a zero ground speed. And then if you make a forward input on the left controller or a lateral input on the right control, instead of accelerating, you just go to a proportional rate. So long story short, if you decelerate into the TRC mode, it's a hands-free hover. And then you can adjust your position with small translations to sweeten up the landing spot. And then you just push forward on the stick to come to the ground. And that's it. It's not, at least in the one helicopter I've flown, you're constantly making lots of little inputs and like using your spider senses to keep, you know, the elephant balanced on top of the beach ball. And this is just not like that. In fact, our chief test pilot's main input to people that don't have a fly-by-wire background is do less. And so that was my first flights in the airplane. I was like, you know, trying really hard to do a good job and making lots of tiny inputs that were like totally not required. And the secret sauce with this airplane is just do less.
Yeah, no, and then that makes a lot of sense. You already said it, but that kind of cemented in my head. So basically the left-hand control, you just, that's literally go and stop. and the right-hand control is up and down and left and right, obviously. And I could see how that really would be difficult for a helicopter pilot who's used to, that collective being the up and down control.
Well, it was really interesting too to for you to point out the fact that you have no pedals and you've got the twist in the stick, and you know that on the one hand that might seem a little bit foreign to pilots of a certain generation, but those of us that have been involved in PC flight sims, you know, have known for many decades, like the old Microsoft Sidewinder joystick and everything, a whole bunch of those gaming sticks introduced that twist axis. I'm not saying that they invented it, but that was something that I think is familiar to a particular generation and younger.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting. We do, we're operating at Marina Airport. It's a public uncontrolled field. And so for a lot of our testing where we want to use the runway, we'll do a hover pickup and kind of a hover taxi onto the runway and then depart down the runway. And I think we've flown the airplane remote controlled from the ground a ton. But when we first got in the airplane and started flying it inhabited, that was one of the surprising things where to do the like accelerating taxi turn onto the runway. You know, you're using left control to accelerate, you're commanding bank with the lateral on the right control and sort of coordinating with twist as you come around the corner to the capture the center line. And it just, it's a, just super intuitive. I think there was, you know, that was one of the things we were worried about. How was the twist axis going to work? And there's been past programs that have used that architecture, but it was a pleasure to see that it was like a non-event for us.
Oh, that's really, really interesting.
Before we continue, we'd like to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all of your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use the coupon code GREEN15, that's GREEN15, at crewchiefsystems.com. Thanks again to Crew Chief Systems for sponsoring the Green Dot.
Now you've talked about flying it, you know, remotely from the ground versus, and then, you know, flying it crewed. Is the ultimate goal for these to be autonomous or optionally piloted, or do you even, is that even on your horizon?
Yeah, for sure. Autonomy is definitely on the roadmap because, you know, it's a 5-seat airplane. And if you can sell an extra seat, that makes a huge difference. How you go about certifying and operating an airplane like that in a real traffic environment, like that's further out, at least on our technology horizon. So in the near term, we've done everything pilot in the loop. So we've either flown it remotely from the ground. So we've got a copy of the onboard flight deck in the ground control station. And then we've got the onboard operations. And so in general, we do higher risk testing piloted from the ground and the things that require pilot in the loop onboard.
I'll apologize. Once again, this may be outside the realm, but just out of curiosity, do you think is there a transition point between piloted and autonomous where you might actually have passengers, but it be remotely piloted?
I don't know. We haven't really talked about that. I think the progression that you're more likely to see is reduced pilot workload, like added features. So the training overhead for qualifying as a pilot like goes down over time, and then like stepping over to like a full autonomy with no pilot on board. And the autonomy development's not my department, but
sure.
We haven't talked about remote flights from the ground. We're not allowed to fly the flight test airplanes with someone on board remotely piloted from the ground, for what it's worth.
Fair enough. So you mentioned a little bit about the all the safety features of the aircraft, certainly with the flight control system and things like that. Obviously with a vehicle like this, you know, it's not a helicopter, so it can't auto-rotate, but you do have distributed power and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about the redundancies that are built into the aircraft for safety?
Yeah, you bet. Like you say, it doesn't have the rotor inertia to auto-rotate, so we got to make thrust and we got to control attitude all the time. And so there's no combination of things breaking that can get you to a condition where that could occur. So there's two of everything. There's six propellers, but the propulsion motors that drive them are dual wound. And so it's like really two motors in one, and they're each powered from a separate power source. So there's four batteries and they map to the 12 motors in a clever way. And then additionally, the tilting system is redundant mechanically and electrically at each station. So you got dual tilts, the variable pitch is the same way. The control surfaces are not dual powered, but there's just lots of them. So you can accommodate, you know, any amount of failures with those. And then the network and computing, the air data, the sensing, all of that has hardware redundancy and power source redundancy. So the airplane is pretty robust. The other challenge is to make sure you don't run it out of gas. And so a big challenge for these type of vehicles is conveying to the pilot what the airplane is capable of doing so that they don't commit to you know, a type of landing or a phase of flight that they can't finish.
Right. And just on that point, is the, have you guys considered, hybrid propulsion, you know, with a turbine engine on board for the distributed power?
Yeah, I don't know if y'all saw in the news, we converted one of the early prototypes to run on a cryogenic hydrogen fuel cell. So we did, like more than 5 hour flight with vertical takeoff and landing with the hydrogen system on board.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah. So, and that was like, I don't know, that was a while ago, like more than a year ago, but I got to do some of those flights. We believe we did the first eVTOL in-flight meals. So, the 5 hour flights, they're remotely piloted from the ground, but, people like brought us in the control room, brought us snacks, which was pretty fun. and then, recently, we've got turbine electric hybrid. So we've modified one of the production prototypes to have a turbine engine again for, as like a technology demonstrator.
Sure.
So I know you mentioned this earlier as part of the certification and the testing and the amount of redundancy that you've just laid out there, the safety features, it's remarkable. And I think it certainly goes a lot deeper than people might expect. But if I gave you a hypothetical, and I'll use myself as the example. So I win the lottery, I go buy one of these, and I'm ignoring the part where you're telling me about energy management and making sure that I've got battery power. I'm flying along and I just run it out of juice. So just making clear, this is my fault, not Joby's fault. I'm the idiot in this scenario. And so there's at least a reasonable amount of wing area and tail surface area. What does a glide speed or glide ratio look like? What's my outcome in that situation?
Well, first of all, you would like have to, there's the airplane's working really hard not to let you get in that situation. But if you get in that situation, it's a pretty high LRD airplane. We've got a best glide speed. So it'd be like any normal airplane. The interesting thing is if you're going really fast, the way the electric propulsion works, if you slow down, the electrical load reduces and you may actually have some propulsion. So if you were going really fast, the first thing you would do is slow down, see what you got. And then if you just really abused it to where you lost the propulsion function, the cutoff for propulsion is a lot higher voltage than the rest of the airplane. So all the control surfaces, all the computers, everything still works. And you would slow to a best glide speed, pitch to the expected flight path angle, which I think is somewhere around 5 degrees down at the best glide speed, if I remember right. And then it's like a normal airplane. So I think it's like in the low 90 knot range, something like that is your glide speed.
That's great.
And then you go to a runway and land like an airplane.
Sure.
I've got we use 4Flight and I've got the glide ring set up and it looks about like my RV.
Interesting. You know, you got to say when you look at it, you say, okay, there's a reasonable amount of wing area there, but you know, that obvious laypersons, maybe even sort of less informed laypersons. Well, what happens when you run out of batteries? It's that number of around 90 knots is a lot more sort of reasonable and manageable than I might've guessed. I figured, you know, you said, well, you got to keep it at 120 knots and find a nice long runway, but you'll have control to get it down, but down in the 90s, I mean, that's not terrible at all.
Yeah.
Well, so it's interesting because we don't like, stalls aren't a maneuver you're going to do in this airplane. If you slow down and pull back on the stick, the airplane just allocates propulsion to make up the difference. But to define the design reference speeds for certification, that's a lot of those trace back to a fixed wing stall speed. So we have to put enough wing there to make the design speeds work out for the types of operations we want to do. So on a desert island, we might have less wing and go faster, but it ends up being pretty balanced.
Well, I guess one other question, this is maybe a bit of a more of an operational question, but certainly it's a flight testing question too. You know, you just mentioned there's different parts of the world that you're looking to fly these aircraft. And one of the places is the Northeast, which coming from there, I can tell you is plenty of IFR days, plenty of rain, plenty of sleep, plenty of snow. What are kind of your weather limitations operating these aircraft?
I mean, right out of the gate, we're VFR only, like we're laser focused on initial type cert. And so it's VFR airplane to start, but we're even for the VFR, we're going to have to show that we're good for an unintentional 5 minute icing encounter. Mm. So we're doing a bunch of sim work around that. The expect rain to be fine. No known icing conditions, like there's no heated wing, no heated props. We've got heated probes. So I think like a normal GA airplane with no ice kit is kind of the model.
Okay.
Yeah. And one other quick question for you, Zach, and that is, can you tell us a little bit about charge times? And again, maybe that's nudging more into that operational side of things again, but just, I know that's something that people are curious about. Well, I fly from point A to point B, and maybe that's, you know, obviously I haven't exhausted the battery, but that's a, you know, that's maybe a close to my max range. What's my downtime like on the other end before I can come back?
Yeah. And this is like feeds back into like the, what trips are like good trips to do, like ties into the charge time and the airplane turnover. The goal is to get the charge time down around a similar number to what it takes to unload passengers and load a new set and get everybody secure, and have charge time not dominate the on-ground time of the airplane is the goal. And so we invested heavily in making the charge as rapid as possible. And there's another great podcast about our ground support system interface that talks about our connections, not just an electrical connection, but there's a data connection and really excitingly a liquid connection. And so we can do the rapid charges by connecting rapidly, putting the batteries at a temp that lets us to do high rate charging, charge it, and then rapidly condition the batteries back to an optimal for whatever the flight is that's coming up next. And so that ability to control the thermal state of all that battery mass is sort of the secret sauce to doing the rapid charge turnarounds. So for short flights, like, you know, charges like in the sub 10 minute range are totally reasonable. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, to carry all the margins for all the different contingencies that may occur. The battery's not like empty at the end of a flight. It's actually still fairly full. And if you're not going all the way to a full state of charge, you can charge pretty rapidly up to a usefully high state of charge. And there's kind of like a sweet spot. I'm like making like massaging globe hand gestures of like all the different constraints that they go in there. But it's that's one of the things we're really excited about, is that interface. And so, I mean, if you've got four passengers that you're trying to get in and out, I mean, you can imagine the fastest you could possibly get them to unbuckle, get them out of the airplane, get the new people in, get them buckled, get them briefed, and then get out of Dodge. So I think the pilot checklist, the planning, the charging, and the service side of getting people on and off the airplane are all trying to converge on this minimum ground time so we can keep the airplane in the air as much as possible.
Wow.
I keep saying airplane. I mean, aircraft.
Aircraft. Yeah. Scott, could you do like a find and replace through the audio?
Yeah. Is there like an audio strike through?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, I tell you what, Zach, we're getting to the end of our time, and but boy, we sure appreciate you taking the time to join us. Welcome back to the show. That was a great reminder that you'd been on. I took a quick glance. I think it was 7 years ago, or 6 or 7 years ago, or something, to talk about Stratolaunch. So, as Tom pointed out at the top of the episode, that's a first. But thank you so much for taking the time to join us and enlighten us. I know we learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners will have as well.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
That's great. All right, then. Well, speaking of thank yous, thanks as always to our sponsor, Crew Chief Systems, for keeping this podcast up and going. And especially thanks to everyone out there who's listening, and those of you that take the time to leave reviews on iTunes or Spotify or Stitcher or any of those other places where you get your podcasts. Those reviews are a big deal to us, and that's how we show you know, the rest of the organization that this podcast is a project worth doing, and everybody agrees on that. So please keep those comments coming. You can leave those reviews. As I said, you can send us email at feedback@eaa.org. And visit the individual episode pages on our blog, which is inspire.eaa.org. And there's a podcast section there. But please do keep those comments coming in, and let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear more of. With that, thanks again to our guest, Zach. Thanks to Tom for co-hosting, and Scott behind the big board to make it all sound good by the time you hear it. And we look forward to catching up to you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.